This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill, joined today by Sharifa Williams, who is now our resident expert on parenting books. That was me for a while, Sharifa. I had the torch for a while.
Oh, really? Oh, you handed it off.
Yeah, among the editorial staff, I mean, I'm not the only parent here, of course, but I am a nonfiction reader heavily.
Yeah.
And I had kids, and I was writing for the site, and sort of by default fell to me, though, you know, other people have had children, and well, I guess my partner Michelle had the children. I was along for the ride that has been. So we're going to talk. I'm going to talk to you about that a little bit here in a second. We've got a bit of a potpourri of book news.
Yeah.
A couple of housekeeping things before we get into the news of the week. Several things. One, you've got a little more time to send in moms, dads, and grads requests. If you've got a recommendation request for any of the people that fit that tripartite slash configuration, please do. Or even if you don't, this is just the vessel to which we pour in our biannual recommendation request water. So if it's something for you, for anybody else, for you know, keep it in your back pocket. podcast@bookriot.com. Also, you might be interested in listening to the most recent episode of First Edition that went out yesterday. It is on the 40th anniversary of The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros, which there's a new edition from the Everyman's Library, which is kind of the occasion for the interview with John Philip Santos, who is a professor, but also a lifelong friend of Cisneros, who wrote the introduction to this new Everyman's Library. So we talk about Cisneros' career, this book, its publication history. It's like 20, 25 minutes. So if you're a fan of that book, for sure. And it's also a good, really good way to figure out what that, you know, the history of that book and learn more about it. And if you pick it up, not for nothing, it's like 130 pages. You can get through it really quickly, House on Mango Street. So anyway, check that out there. Oh, I think those are the pre-gamey things. Let's do our sponsor break and get into news of the week.
Today's episode is brought to you by Gallery Books. So Anna Green thought she was marrying Liam West for access to subsidized family housing while at UCLA, which is an interesting reason to marry someone, but you know, in this economy. So anyway, she signed divorce papers when the graduation caps were tossed, and she thought she was done. She wasn't. 3 years later, Anna is a starving artist living paycheck to paycheck while West is a Stanford professor. Now, he is part of a conglomerate. His family owns this mega grocery store chain. He's not interested in working for them, but he is interested in those greenbacks, honey, that come in the form of a $100 million inheritance. To get it, he has to be married for 5 years. That's where our girl Anna comes back into play. So the two will fake a marriage, but as he gets to know her and gets to appreciate the feisty, foul-mouthed, paint-splattered girl that she is, he'll begin to wonder if the money is worth the love of his life. Pick up The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren to find out if it is. And thanks again to Gallery Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Diana Dixon has a busy summer and no time for tall, gorgeous hockey player Shane's shenanigans. Because you know what? If they shenan once, they'll shenan again. So she thinks she knows exactly who he is when he moves into her apartment building. But turns out Shane's sick of hookups and tired of being on the rebound after his long-term girlfriend called it quits. But when his ex comes back into the picture, he needs a plan. And who better to play his new girlfriend than his sassy new neighbor? So a fake relationship might be perfect for Diana's own ex issues, but Diana is used to living by the rules. Will she learn that when it comes to love, rules are meant to be broken? Make sure to check out The Dixon Rule by Elle Kennedy. Elle Kennedy is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author with over a million copies of her books sold. So this is going to be another banger, y'all. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters is an intimate portrait of two generations, a granddaughter and a grandmother, coming to terms with what it means to be family, Black women, and alive in a world on fire. In heartfelt lyrical prose, Mary Inez Hegler weaves an unforgettable story of the climate crisis, Black resistance, and the enduring power of family. narrated by Jonice Abbott Pratt and written by climate justice writer Mary Anise Hegler. The Troubled Waters audiobook is available everywhere May 7th. It follows Corinne as she plans to stage a dramatic act of resistance and peels back the scabs of her family wounds and puts her safety in jeopardy. Both grandmother and granddaughter must bring their unspoken secrets into light to find a path to healing. Known for her essays that dissect and interrogate the climate crisis, drawing heavily on her personal experience as a Black woman with deep roots in the South, Mary Anise Hegler brings us her first work of fiction titled Troubled Waters. Make sure to pick it up. Thanks again to Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters, for sponsoring this episode.
Sharifa, you wrote for Better Living Through Books, our, I guess, self-help productivity newsletter. Stepped in for Rebecca, who's been captaining that ship, to write about books about being pregnant and being a new parent. That was kind of the frame, right?
That's correct, yeah. And it was framed for first-time parents in particular.
Okay. I don't know that anything changes the second time around, to tell you the truth. You did two for one, so I don't know. You were a first-time parent and then a second-time parent real quick after, I'm guessing how that went.
Yeah.
So what do you want? I mean, I read the piece. I'll link it to it in the show notes. I think it's a wonderful piece. Like, I guess, what surprised you? What did you learn? What would you pass on to other people who are listening to a bookish podcast or may themselves become pregnant, someone in their life? What's to know? What's to learn? What's to recommend?
I think the thing that I sort of joked about in the piece, and that I will say I do take seriously and want to instill in other people, is that you will get a lot of like book recommendations and will feel like you have to read all the books to understand what's happening, because it's a complicated and complex thing that involves emotions, your physical being, and your relationships. And I would just say, do not allow yourself into the trap of thinking you have to consume all of the things about pregnancy and parenting, even as I am putting another piece of content out there in the world about it. But the thing I wanted to get across here was that, you know, pick and choose the books that really speak to where you're at, because everybody's experience is so unique. And in my case, the thing that was really helpful was the author I think I focused on the most at the top, which is Emily Oster, who is really into data and the science of the studies that talk a lot about pregnancy and parenting and how to raise your kids, because there's so much advice out there coming from all sorts of people who don't really have a lot of expertise. And I thought that it was really helpful and a big relief to actually see the data and the studies behind the recommendations. So if that's you too, I just like, if you can't bother or are too tired to read anything, I would just go ahead and look up Emily Oster if you are of the same ilk, and just start there.
I mean, Moneyball for parenting is not the worst way to describe what Oster's trying to do, right? It's like there's this whole realm of, you know, the baby industrial complex and commentary and advice and exhortations and shame and sort of moral imperatives about what you should or shouldn't do. And she brought a different kind of lens to like, wait, what actually matters here? What can you control? What can't you control? What's statistically significant? Are there even studies about some of this advice? For sure. I thought you made a point that I found myself. I did a bunch of reading as we were having our first child, especially, but then also after we needed some sleep help and some other things.
But
you made a good point. I don't have the name of the book in front of me. Maybe you have it off the top of your head, where you said like, there's a bunch of like, you know, the baby's microbiome and like philosophy and theory. But then there's actually, at some point, you're going to have a physical being like in front of you, and you have to do stuff with it, like, and take care of it. I kind of resonated with that. It felt like the actual brass tacks of how to get through the days with the newborn. I guess maybe that's less interesting than here's how you raise a baby Mozart, or, you know, here's all this other kind of stuff that goes on, but kind of weirdly underrepresented in the literature, it feels to me.
It was incredible. The book that I was calling out was Moms on Call, Basic Baby Care. It's by Laura Hunter and Jennifer Walker. And it was the first book I came across where it was just like, oh my goodness, like this is just like the straightforward, this is what you need to do step by step to take care of this child once you bring them home from the hospital. Because I had been to parenting classes and I had read a bunch of books and it was just like, but how do I get this baby? Like how I'm being entrusted with this human being out of the hospital. And I mean, I had the benefit of NICU nurses who were great and who helped us learn a lot of stuff as we spent time in the hospital and literally lived out of the hospital. And
yeah, you had an unusual experience in that regard, I think.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, like, not everybody has that. It's not like the ideal experience, but not everybody has that, and they just go home with this baby, and then what if it just occurs to them, like, they, I don't know how to put this baby to bed, like, how to
where do I put it? No, I know, I remember having this, how do I hold the, you know, all that, I mean, support the head and the bottom and all, but there's like, can I just sit it on the ground? I mean, sure.
Right.
I mean, the answer is yeah, you can. It's wild, you know, because, and then there's so much, people want to do well, right? If you're the kind of person that is interested in all and even consider reading a book about being a good parent, I think you're in probably the top quartile of people who care about being a good parent, even though a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have some family members that are going to have a baby in the fall, and they're going through this stage you go through, and I don't even really know what to name it, which is I want to do a good job, but I also know what I'm doing. So what I'm going to do is research all the strollers, and I'm going to really deep dive on making your own baby food. And I'm going to do all this prep and shopping and research and reading and Instagram scrolling, which please be careful out there for yourself in these spots, because that's all you can do before the baby comes, right? You can't once the baby comes, for most people, it's kind of like what they say about the, you know, a plan, you know, is all well and good until you actually have to enact it. And then you meet the kid and you meet yourself and how you're going to be in these situations. And kids are so different. I'm sure even between your two, you're starting to notice differences. That any generalized advice for raising a kid kind of goes out the window. But what you do need to do is try to get some damn sleep and try to get some food in
that thing,
which is legitimate. You also mentioned what to expect when you were expecting, and you looked at that with, I don't know, you came into it with skepticism, and I think rightly so. Can you tell me why, and then also what was your experience of reading what to expect when you're expecting?
Well, when I initially started reading some books, like I was doing a lot of skimming books in the beginning because I was trying to figure out what I needed to actually get out of these books and what to spend time on. And there was always a mention of what to expect. And it was a book I just knew, even as somebody who for most of her life did not intend to have children. I knew the book because it's ubiquitous. It's just everywhere. And everybody talks about it. And every time I got a mention of it, it was always like, oh, you know, it was rueful. Like, we have to ruefully recommend what to expect because it's like, it just has some dated language and it does not take a full view of things, and it sometimes tries to push a certain type of agenda. Like the breastfeeding thing is a big one in What to Expect. Mm-hmm. That is like a contentious thing, you know, that there's a whole, the blog wars is how they talk about that whole conversation. And so I was like, oh boy, I'm going to be reading this book and it's like this big tome you have to get through, and it's going to be like somebody lecturing me with, you know, old wives' tales and like hearsay stuff about, you know, how to be a good parent, be a good pregnant person, and a lot of, I don't know, a certain type of snobbery, I guess. So when I actually read it, I did see some of that, but I knew to ignore some of it.
Your little immunity built up, right? Your guard was up for the worst of that,
But it was the most expansive, like, chapter by chapter you could follow what the heck was happening to your body, yes, sort of, yeah, thing. And it had asides for, you know, the partner who's not giving birth and things like that, that I think, I thought it was more helpful to me than to my actual partner, who is like, yeah, that's fine, whatever. But I was like, oh, understanding the other perspective and what's being told to that person is interesting also. So I still had to include it as a recommendation. And I guess I
would too. That's why I was especially interested in, because it does, I think you want to go into it with a, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But in terms of the actual, like, it's week 11 in your pregnancy, here's what's going on and what you might expect your body to be doing and what to look out for. And, you know, that's part of it too, because it's, I mean, this is going to sound so reductive, but it's a super physical process and it changes week by week and month by month. And it's exciting, but also pretty weird, right? Like, it's pretty weird, at least it was to me, when, you know, looking at the belly and you can see, like, the kid moving around. It's like, you know, if you don't know that's a normal thing to see, that looks like, you know, a Sigourney Weaver should be starring in the movie. Like, it's pretty weird, Sharifa. Like, if you haven't experienced it before.
It is weird. It's like nothing you could, like, the it really does drive home the miraculous nature of the body, like what it is capable of. I still can't wrap my head around it, that, you know, there's just this human being that lives inside of you.
And, you know, the other thing, again, we're book people, so we're gonna say that's it's worth reading. There is a part of me though that's like, it can be so overwhelming. I still feel like maybe there's a one volume book out there that some part of the Oster, some part of the 0 to 6 months, some part of, like, can you give me the anthology, right? Can you give it to me in an all-in-one? And I know that's asking a lot. But I have this idea, and your piece reminded me of it. I kind of wish there was almost like a, it wouldn't be choose your own adventure, because that suggests a kind of volition that you don't really get when you're having kids, because things happen and they turn out certain ways and have behaviors and health in their own bodies. But like, that, like, okay, you're at this point, and if this is going on with you, skip to this chapter. Or if this happens to you, move to this. So, like, the book itself could be, like, because there's all these variables, right? Like, are you going to breastfeed? Are you not going to? Do you have a live-in help? Or, you know, do you have someone around? Do you not? Are you going to be working? Are you not? Are you doing this versus this? Because each one of those variables makes a huge difference for how your life gets put together. And you make 6 or 7 of those decisions that we all have to make, or some of them are made for us, and your life looks a lot different than just here's what to do if you have kids. So I don't know. Maybe that's asking too much. And I know all kids are different. And I think that's one of the things that most of us have to learn at some point, is like, okay, you can do as much reading, prep, whatever you want to do, but at some point, that unique individual that is in your care is going to defy all extant wisdom you can access, and you're going to have to kind of come up with a strategy of your own.
Oh, yeah. Those kids are going to test you. And I would say it almost sounds like, not to sound non-bookish here, but that almost sounds like a sort of an app type thing. I could see, like,
a hypertext. App. Almost like it's just a degenerator. So I do cloth diapers, and I'm a single parent, and I work nights. What? Help me. I don't know. I'm just, you know, you could have a couple different ways of going that way. Anything else that you would, anything else that were surprises to you in the reading, or omissions that you still wish there was something else out there for people?
I mean, I think that it is sort of that conundrum of, there are always going to be unique things that happen to you or around you. And I mean, I think that there is unfortunately no one book that will answer all of those questions, I guess, is the part that I didn't really include there, but that I really sort of had to take heart in. And, you know, Emily Oster is coming out with this new book, The Unexpected, and it's sort of trying to confront that. But, you know, there are so many things, and I will say that there is no book or blog or whatever that can ever replace a medical professional's advice, especially your own medical professional who knows your particular situation
and you trust
vitals and circumstances. Yeah. So.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Let's do a second break there and get to some new stuff.
Today's episode is brought to you by Penguin Team. In a world where the children of the gods inherit their powers, a descendant of the Greek Fates must solve a series of impossible murders to save her sisters, her soulmate, and her city. Descendants of the Fates are always born in threes. There's one to weave, one to draw, and one to cut the threads that connect people to the things they love and to life itself. And the Aura sisters are no exception. There is Io, the youngest, who uses her Fate-born abilities as a private investigator. But her latest job leads her to a horrific discovery. Somebody is abducting women and setting the resulting wraiths loose in the city to kill. Now, the second book in the series, Hearts That Cut, will be on sale June 18th, 2024. This is a must-read for all Greek mythology and fantasy fans. This is dripping with atmosphere, edged with danger. Threads That Bind weaves together a gorgeous dark tapestry of mystery, faded romance, and modern myth. You won't be able to put this one down, and that comes from Alexandra Bracken, New York Times bestselling author of Lore. So make sure to pick up Threads That Bind by Kitsa Hatsopoulou, and thanks again to Penguin Teen for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Sourcebooks Landmark. So King Solomon says something very interesting to his son before he dies, and that is, quote, "Don't let the white man take the house," end quote. These, as I just mentioned, are King Solomon's last words to his son as he dies. Now, all four Solomon siblings must return to North Carolina to save the kingdom, their ancestral home, and 200 acres of land from a development company. Told in alternating viewpoints, Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris is a searing portrait of the power of family and letting go of things that no longer serve you, exploring the burden of familial expectations, the detriment of miscommunication, and the lessons and legacies we pass on to our children. It's an explosive and emotional story of four siblings, each fighting their own personal battle, because who isn't, who return home in the wake of their father's death. Make sure to check out Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris, and thanks again to Sourcebooks Landmark for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, we've got a bit of a smorgasbord of interesting adaptation news. I guess why don't you picked out one you were the most interested in, so why don't you take the Crazy Rich Asians news and what you think and what it is.
Yeah, I was really curious about this. I have thoughts about Crazy Rich Asians, and it turns out that it's going to become, you know, it got a film adaptation that was very popular and directed mm-hmm. by John Chu. Of course, it's based on a really popular, very buzzy book as well. And now it's getting a musical, which, I mean, now I absolutely see it. I didn't expect it. But it is like this big, bombastic sort of... There's a lot of fodder for great stage production. As a theater mm-hmm. nerd myself, I always try to visualize. I think it just happens naturally. I visualize what it's going to look like. And so I'm one part excited about this. My mom's Singaporean, so there's... I've always wanted to, like... ask her. I know she read Crazy Rich Asians, and I know she watched.
But you never asked her. You're not sure, mom. How? What, give me the DL on your take. Give me your hot take on Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, I asked her in passing, and I got like a sort of like quippy answer, but didn't like dive into it.
Okay.
She loves this sort of story, so I think it was always going to appeal to her, but I wanted to know what she thought they did not get right about Singapore. And this is a very different version of Singapore than
you know.
This is the rich, mega rich world of Singaporeans, but now I just want to, I want this to actually happen and play through just so that I can, I kind of want to take her to see it and then ask her that way, because I think it would be great fun. And I just want to hear her sort of Settler and Waldorf version of, you know.
We should do a podcast. We'll mic you guys up. You mic her up. She won't know it. And we can get the raw footage of Sharifa's mom giving her blistering, scorched earth takes, or you know, be completely enthralled and become a CRA theater nut and go every Wednesday for a week and know all the songs.
Knowing my mom, this would have to be rated a explicit episode because of the.
Oh, really? She works a little blue.
She does.
That's funny because you really don't, Sharifa. Really don't at all. Even off mic, you don't.
We are very different people, and that's great. Okay,
wow. Yeah.
We get along. Yeah, we're very different.
Yeah, I've never even seen you throw an F-bomb in Slack or, you know, anything else like that. Sharifa, for people who don't know, is a cool customer. So I'm not surprised, but it hadn't occurred to me until this moment. I don't even think I've ever seen one as a joke. So anyway.
That's funny. I mean, it's funny because Singapore is a very, like, there is a lot of, my side of the family there is very, they definitely run, you know, they're very different, you know, from me in that same respect as well. And so, like, it would be great to one day, I need to read more books that are set in Singapore because I would love to see that side.
Yeah.
But this is really interesting, and there are a lot of really interesting people who are involved in it. Like, mm-hmm. one of the playwright who's involved also has written on, like, Rami, which is a great show. And so I'm really curious about how it's all going to come out.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that John Chu is, you know, in this world and continues to work on this project. And I guess I wonder what that means for the rest of the movies, right? Because it feels like this could suck up some of the creative attention that, and I don't know what the status of the funding of the other movies are. Crazy Rich Asians did very well, and it was seen as a real boon and maybe a gate opener for different kinds of productions, especially starring Asian people and Asian stories. I don't know. Maybe Michelle Yeoh's dance card is full after. I mean, seriously, this thing's going to happen. I don't know. It may be hard to get some people back for some of these things. Let's see. I did not see this coming. It is a Spanish language adaptation of 100 Years of Solitude, the contemporary classic. I mean, if you're thinking of what goes on the top 10 or 15 books people think of when they think of like late 20th century classics, especially in the U.S., internationally, the list is real short, and 100 Years of Solitude might be number one on that list. Had to work on that for a Patreon episode anyway. But it's getting a full-budgeted adaptation. It looks very beautiful. Coming to Netflix, I feel like this is the kind of thing that will, you know, subtitles are always more difficult for Americans, though, with Parasite. And I just watched the finale of Shogun last night, and it was amazing, and that's largely subtitled. So maybe I'm turning around on this idea, but it looks great. I don't know what to say about it, except it looks great. Marquez is... what he does on the page is hard to translate to screen. And some of it is the magical realism, though I think that's not as difficult as the vibes, frankly, that Marquez can do. So I'll be certainly curious to watch it. I don't know if this is something that was being made in South America and Netflix just picked it up, or if it was commissioned, you know, if it was bought and funded with an eye towards the U.S. market being the main thing. I'm not really sure. Did you have a chance to look at the trailer at all, Sharifa?
I did. It looks real. Like, I really want to watch it, and it's one of those books that I do feel kind of bad about never having read. So of course, when adaptations like this come out, I have that conflicted feeling of like, should I?
I gotta choose. You must choose, Sharifa. You must choose.
I have a feeling, knowing myself, I'm probably just going to watch it first.
Well, you're in the early days of having kids, so you have all the passes in the world to, you know, the book nerd passes are, you can't run out at this point. I mean, one of the great things is, like, it is such a, a feeling, and it is relatively long, and the title itself does not scream page turner 100 years of solitude. But it is really a wonderful reading experience. Love in the Time of Cholera is my personal favorite. I don't know why, it just it is. But yeah, I'd be curious to see how that turns out. And then sort of a three for Jeff, and these are kind of three for Jeff and Rebecca. I don't know if you have any relationship to Thursday Murder Club, Project Hail Mary, or Transcendent Kingdom. Sharifa, pipe in if, as I go through these real quick, if there's anything that speaks to you. I've been hyping Thursday Murder Club. Again, I was a latecomer writ large, but over the break, I guess it was, the break being the holidays. It's now like almost the middle of the year, so I don't know why I keep thinking Christmas was like 3 weeks ago.
It feels like it.
But I got on the Osmond train with the Thursday Murder Club series, recommended the crap out of it. I'm sure on the Moms, Dads, Grads recommendation, so I will find some place to put this because it is so charming and so fun. For those of you who don't know, it's about a group of English retirees, they call them pensioners, who get kind of pulled together and have a reason to be involved in trying to solve a murder. Again, it doesn't hold up that well to super scrutiny, but you know, suspension of disbelief even happens in these situations. And it's just, Osmond is just sharp enough. I wrote about this in Today in Books. No, he's plenty sharp, but he keeps a little citrus in it, if you know what I mean, Sharifa, mm-hmm. to cut the sweetness.
I like it.
Because there's a version of some of these stories that are about like old people getting together at the end of their, not the end of their life, but in their retirement, in their dotage, that can be saccharine. But A, there's murder, and B, they aren't so pal all the way that there's not some tension between them. That is fun, and it's played for, you know, it's meant to be fun. This is not like David Fincher or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But the casting: Brosnan, Helen Mirren, and Kingsley already. Already
oh, wow.
lined up to be in this.
That
so that is
great.
Not a joke. So that's very cool to see. Project Hail Mary, which is Andy Weir's third novel, and I think probably it's more ambitious than The Martian. I don't know that I'll ever say any of his books top The Martian. There's something about the first one, right? But anyway, this one got a release date, 2026, starring Ryan Gosling in the main role, which had been rumored, and I hadn't heard much about the project in a while, and I am wondering if Gosling's heater that he's on right now from Barbie to Fall Guy, which is getting amazing reviews and coming out like next week, got this greenlit, got the money. It's going to take a lot of money to do. It's another space story. There is an additional element that I don't even trying to synopsize it, which is not a word, will kind of spoil it, so I'm not going to say it here. I'm very, very excited to see. Let me just say that Gosling's casting is important, but his co-star's performance is more important. If you know, you know, I will say about Project Hail Mary right now. And then Yah Jesse is finally, well, it's in development, so you don't know. But Transcendent Kingdom, which is Yah Jesse's second novel, which Rebecca and I did a podcast episode No, I think that was actually me, Rincey, and Liberty talked about Transcendent Kingdom way back in the day.
Oh, wow.
In an unusual pairing there.
Yeah.
A production company, Yvonne Orgies. I was looking for a pronunciation for this.
Orgie,
yeah. I was trying not to say that, Sharifa, honestly. I was like, that can't be right. But anyway, here we are.
I know her from Insecure, so that's why.
Oh, okay, good. You said it first, not me. Which is a smaller book than Homecoming. It's about a neuroscientist and thinking about growing up in rural Alabama. It's a cool story. I guess I just didn't know if it was... I don't know if the story was big enough to warrant a movie, but I'm thrilled that it is. And maybe it's like a character study. I mean, anything can be great if it's good. I wasn't sure. I thought maybe Homecoming, but that's a bigger canvas. It'd be very expensive to make. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm thrilled. I don't know what to say about it, but that's coming out too.
I'm in the same boat. I was really hoping that Homegoing would be like the movie that got the adaptation, because I think that's still one of my all-time favorite books ever.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. So,
it is
but that's
truly
a huge book to...
Yeah, I mean, the scale is like... Even than some of the... I mean, again... It's multi-generational, but it has its mm-hmm. the beginning in the African slave trade, like on the coast of Africa, and these slave trading. I mean, it's hell. It's a hell within hell, right? I mean, these kinds of places. And it would go further than anything I think we've seen put to film to cover. I mean, anything, honestly, like 12 Years a Slave or anything else like that. It's just another level. It's international. There's a lot of boats. I mean, I'm not just in terms of the production. It's just a huge sort of story.
Yeah.
It would have needed. I don't know if Barry Jenkins had decided to do that rather than Underground Railroad. I mean, I guess he still could, but it would need to be that kind of a production, like probably something huge like that. But thrilled to see. I'll tell you what, it'd be a wonderful part for some young actress. It's a wonderful part.
Oh yeah,
in Transcendent Kingdom. Whoever gets that.
Yeah, I look forward to it.
And I guess that kind of takes us through those particular things. I linked to it yesterday, and maybe, how are we doing on time? We'll do some front list for you. I don't want to put you on the hook for what you've been reading recently, knowing what's going on in your house these days. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you've got something else to say, you will. I can do a couple of things. But I think I talked a while ago, Lincoln Michael writes the Substack Countercraft. He's a novelist and essayist, and he writes a lot about the craft and the publishing industry. But every now and again, a story goes around about how book sales aren't going very well, and what a bummer the book industry is.
Yeah.
And he often doesn't rebut it necessarily, but it gives it context. And so someone else had written a piece using... And that piece had used PRH's testimony in the case that DOJ brought to prevent it from buying Simon & Schuster to say, basically, boy, doesn't the book industry suck? Isn't it so sad? And isn't it so weak? And Michael makes the good case that that was motivated reasoning. PRH's plan there was to make it seem like it is cool for PRH to buy Simon & Schuster, because these are kind of a bunch of weak ducks anyway, and it doesn't really hurt. This is a failing, difficult industry, so there's no real competitive problem with that buying that. So they're very motivated there. But then also just it's a chance to look at, like, what is the state of the publishing industry? And what is the state of it in terms of how many people are buying books? What is the directionality of it? Is it Chicken Little to say the sky is falling and it's not? Is it burying your head in the sand to say actually things are fine? And the top note for me, I guess, is things are pretty much as they have been for a while in terms of printed book sales. There was a real dip about 10 years ago, right? That has come back, and there was a COVID spike, and then we're back down a little bit. And we're not selling as many print books as we were. You and I are not selling print books as we were in, say, 2007, right? But also we're selling more than we were selling in 2004, like 100 million print units. And these are print books, I should say. So in 2004, 648 million. In 2023, 767 million. And that doesn't include certainly from 2004, doesn't include the ebook boom or, importantly, the audiobook boom, right?
Yes.
And he says, Americans probably buy more than a billion books, and I think it's quite a bit more than that. I think print books are probably a third of the books that are actually bought between ebooks and audiobooks. There's reasons we don't actually know. It's proprietary and fragmented and so on and so on. But, like, it's, I don't know. Like, the good news is it's pretty stable. The bad news is also pretty stable because the U.S. is bigger than it was 15 years ago. And so you'd like to see proportionally more books being bought. But I think the story about book sales in America is kind of boring. Maybe that's the thing that's hard to say. It's like, it's kind of where it is. I don't know, Sharifa, I'm sure you had a chance to look at this. Did anything else jump out to you about this particular piece?
Yeah, I think it was correct in the it's challenging and obscuring to try and take something about, like, some big sweeping statement about the state of publishing from a trial of this sort because of the way things are trying to be messaged in the court, on behalf of making this deal happen, which it didn't. But having read the original piece that this is countering, you know, I have definitely grown weary of the sort of, you know, the state of publishing is in a spiral and things, books are not selling, people aren't reading. I've grown weary of that conversation. So mm-hmm. I immediately came to that piece with a little bit of skepticism, especially when there's no, you know, a statement like that holds no space for sort of nuance and seems to trade in cynicism. Like I have to have a lot of skepticism about that. So it was good to read this, but also, yes, it was like, oh, there is no revelatory thing to be learned about where we are with books. I mean, I feel like we would have seen the seeds of mm-hmm. that spiral in just like, just doing our thing and being people in the book world. And I was like, I truly have not seen anything like
that. No, so. I haven't either. And, you know, I follow the financial reporting of the major publishers.
Right.
And, you know, coming off COVID, they definitely have negatives, but the comps are very difficult. Their 2021, 2022 results were phenomenal, right? I think the thing that is true, and if you listen to a show like this, you may know this already. I think what people don't know, and it's more of a knowledge gap than it is a misconception, like how to know how a particular book does or did is very, very hard. And so there's a huge knowledge gap. Whereas something like movies, for example, we get the box office that comes out every week. You can look at the box office results. And I think that is actually kind of interesting for the movie going public, because then you kind of know what's popular and it can momentum of its own. Whereas for us, you know, we have, you know, Danica does the rounds ups of the best-selling books of the week, and she kind of has to do some Kremlinology because she's looking at five different lists, and they're definitely similar homologies, but they don't overlap because they measure different things and they weight things differently. And it's really hard to know. And then there are also so many books being sold that to pick out something that is having really breakout success can be hard to see because it's buried in so much other data that doesn't or does not exist. For example, I was just looking in Slack today, and Jamie Canavis, who does a lot of our TBRage, Tailored Book Recommendations, shout out to that, mytbr.co, was just saying that Hanif Abdurraqib's There's Always This Year is not available in most of the major book warehouses that we use to fulfill TBR, which means it's selling very well, right? It sold out its initial print run. It hasn't been out that long. And that story gets buried because there's not data, and what data there is so like, that's a great story that I wish there was an easier way to tell, because then it could get its momentum, right? Like, maybe even us talking about it here will make it more likely that if someone sees the local bookstore happens to have one, to go buy it, because they're kind of like, it has its own kind of momentum. But because we don't have the data and there's so much of it, it's hard to pick out interesting stories about what's popular and what people are reading.
Yeah, that is both enlightening to learn for the first time and frustrating if you are somebody who is really curious about that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it is not obvious that that is how the data works and that there is no easy way to tell how a book is doing. And if you're an author, I'm sure it's, you know, doubly confusing if you're a first-time author trying to figure this out for yourself.
Right.
Like, I co-edited an anthology, and I just don't pay attention to any of it, to be honest.
Well, at some level, it doesn't help you, right? Like, if there's not that much data, and it's hard to what are you going to do with it? Yeah, it's very interesting. But I think, you know, Michael includes here a piece that the piece he's citing included, which is a helpful chart. It gives you some perspective that Random House breaks its guidelines into who gets what kinds of advance into several categories, right? The lowest category here is category 4. And these are titles with a sales goal of 5,000 to 10,000 units. And I don't know if these are print or not. It's not clear to me. I didn't do the full footnote, but let's just say what they are. And for a title in that range, Random House, the acquiring editor, is guessing, okay, I think this is the kind of range it is, so I am willing to give an advance of $50,000 or less for something like this. And again, this is not all publishing. This is Pingham Random House. They're the largest trade publisher in the world, right? So just, you know, Category three, titles with sales goals of 10,000 to 25,000 units is $50,000 to $150,000. Category two, titles with sales goals of 25,000 to 75,000 units, 150 to 500,000. And then lead titles are 75,000 units and up. That's $500,000 and up. So I guess I knew this kind of range. I guess the thing that surprised me is you can get a $100,000 advance and have a sales expectation of 12,000 copies, essentially, or, you know, or 15 to 17,000 copies to look at that middle of category three. I'm not surprised by that because I just haven't seen it laid out quite like this because that's kind of do you think the average book reader, or I guess podcast at bookriot.com, look at the link in the show notes here and see, does that surprise you out there? To see, does that feel like too much, too little, or what do you think? What do you think people would think, Sharif? Are people like, really, you only have to sell 17,500 copies, and that's looking at $100,000 advance? Or they're like, oh my God, that's not very much money at all. I don't know what civilians think of these kinds of numbers, and why it might matter is a secondary question.
It's interesting because the conversation I hear the most from like your general reader is just about how much money an author might make.
Yeah.
And I think the assumption is that they are selling so many books. Like, I definitely think that they would be surprised that the number was so low for something like Category 3 book, because maybe they're thinking about it in movie terms or something like that, where it's just like, oh, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers, like, right. Especially with like books that they consider best-selling or that they like, they just imagine like there's a big world of a lot of people out there, so it must just be like hundreds of thousands in order to like get something like $100,000, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I do believe this would be a surprisingly low number for people.
Yeah, I guess they probably might think of it somewhat like other mass, mainstream cultural things. Like if you go into a bookstore and see a book there, I guess maybe, and this makes sense to me, that maybe you think that person made it, whatever that sounds like to you. Like they have a published book, it's being carried by Barnes & Noble or their independent bookstore or whatever. Boy, isn't that great? And I'm sure they're a full-time writer making at least an upper middle-class salary, right?
And that exactly.
Yeah. Because even if you're getting $100,000 for a 17,500 print run, again, you're not getting that all at once, just how advances are broken up. You got to pay taxes. You got to pay your agent. That's not you're not living a middle-class life on that, because you're probably not writing one of those a year. And even if you are, you just aren't. That's still hard. To get to be a Category 3 author is flipping hard. It is
really,
hard
really
to
hard.
Do. It's a wonderful success in the larger world of books, even if it isn't sort of, you know, it doesn't pay as well as being a public school teacher, if that's all you're doing. And that's why most people don't. Most people have other gigs that they're using to fill it in. So if you're listening to this, you're probably the kind of person that's interested in things like this, which is why I included here. I can tell you that 13 years ago, before doing Book Riot, I would have eaten this kind of thing with a spoon. Because as just a non-industry person, you have no idea. I had no idea, just none of how this stuff goes. A big hit is 75,000 copies. I mean, it's not that many. That's like that's not even 2,000 copies per state.
Yeah, it seems really small, but I mean, that is. What is a success?
That is what it is. Yeah,
okay.
That is what
you
it
know.
Is. Yeah. Okay. I will talk about some new books. I know it's tough. Is there anything that's been on your radar before I get to mine? Have you been checking out, listening to, browsing, or even considering at this point, Sharif? I would give you credit for.
I mean, it's funny. I have not been because I'm not podcasting regularly right now. I have not been looking at a lot of new books, and I'm catching up on books I have not been able to get to that were big when they came out.
Like, okay.
We're just talking about Hanif Abdurraqib and the thing I'm reading right now. Slowly but surely is They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, which came out like years ago. But I'm like, you know what? I've been wanting to read that book for years, so I'm going to...
Well, that's how... You're now a regular reader, Sharifa. That's how most people, most sane people encounter books. They don't necessarily care that it's new. Just, are they interested in it right then?
Yeah, this is a strange state for me, but that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. Let's see. I just finished Knife by Salman Rushdie. I think Rebecca and I are going to talk about that in detail. So I'm going to put that to the side for a minute.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to withhold, but it's probably...
No, that's
Rebecca
okay.
will get very upset with me if I give all my knife takes right now. Can't. I mean, listen, I got a podcast. I podcast with like 19,000 times a week. So we got to keep things kosher and chill in that regard. I will, you know, the surprise book to me... Josh Bodwell, who is the executive editor over at Godin Books and who joined me on First Edition to talk about The Orchard, I told him, if there's anything that sounds like something I would like, send it my way. I don't do this very often, Sharifa. You know, most of us on BookWrite are pretty protective of our reading time because we know that if you let a few springs in the dam go, you will get inundated with books you don't want. So I'm very careful. But I said, Josh, you know, thanks for coming up. But if there's anything that strikes you, he's like, so he recommended this book by Simon Van Booy, B-O-O-Y. I think that's how you say his last name. Who's had, you know, he has like a dozen books out or something like this. But this book comes out May 7th. So it's in a couple of weeks. Or I don't know. I guess, yeah, probably a week from Tuesday. It's a small book. It's called Sipsworth. And it is the story of this, another, it's English Pensioner Day on the Book Riot podcast. Boy, I'm getting old, Sharifa. 17 to 25 year old me would be like, what has become you decrepit old man? What has happened? You used to listen to Led Zeppelin and read books in translation from Europe. Anyway, it's the story of this older woman, and she's an old woman. It's cool. We'll all be there. We should all be so lucky at someday to be old. She's 83 and she finds herself retired and alone in a very deep way. And I'm not so sure that she's depressed. But it's not far from it. Sort of an existential depression more than a clinical one, I would say. Not having a whole lot of reason to get through her days. And it happens to be the case that she finds herself under the care of a single mouse. And it changes her life, trying to take care of it. And it enters her into a wider world. She makes some connections with other humans and kind of realizes and comes to find some things to care about. It's like 180 pages. I teared up a couple of times. I was telling my daughter about it, and she got super into it. I guess it's also the kind of thing that bears... I don't think it's a spoiler. I was saving this for one of Rebecca and my half-baked idea sections. But you know how for romance, like, there's a happily ever after? Like, there's an expectation of that. Like, it's on the tip. It's not a spoiler to say. I think we need something like that for other genres. To say, you know, the classic one is, does the dog die, right?
Yes.
So DTDD is what we need. Like, does the dog die? And so is it a DL or a DD? Is it a DL, dog lives, or a DD, dog dies? And I guess technically it's a spoiler, but that is a significant difference for Sharifa and the kind of reading experience you're going to have if it's a DD versus a DL book, right?
Yeah, I mean, I loved the way it was dealt with in The Twisted Ones. Oh, good grief. I wish I remembered the author's name.
Wait, Twisted? I don't know
Fisher.
It. Yes. Okay, sorry. Yes, I do know. Right.
Yes. And it is immediately made clear as part of the narrative, T. Kingfisher, as part of the narrative that the dog does not die in this horror novel.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is great. I'm totally fine with this. This does not feel like a spoiler to me, and I'd be happy if all books did this.
Right. Because, and I guess, if you don't want to know what happened in Sipsworth by Salman Van Booy, stop listening to Al. Thank you so much. BookWrite.com/listen for the show notes. Podcast at BookWrite.com. Moms, Dads, Grads. Insert outro music here. And so everyone's gone. Seriously, you're here. You're going to find out about the mouse's fate and the lady's fate. You're still here. This is your last call. Okay. So everything's fine. Everyone survives to the last page. And it's warm and heart moving. But I found myself a little conflicted. I certainly wanted everyone to live. But as I was getting towards the end, it's like, I don't know. Like, if there was some sort of stamp that says the mouse lives and the lady lives too, am I as likely to pick it up? What does that do? I just find it very interesting, right? And maybe, I'm not sure, because there's part of me that definitely wanted to know. I'm not in this kind of a situation so sensitive about it or so attuned to it that I would have not picked it up. Now, if she had adopted a one-year-old and the one-year-old dies, I don't think I am picking that up, right?
No.
You're in the stuff when it comes to that. It goes away to some degree, but it doesn't ever go away. Like, I'm just not interested in that at all. Whatever feeling is trying to be evoked by something bad happened to Kiv, trust me, I've imagined it 10,000 times already before I've read your book about whatever's happening.
Yeah.
So, but like, I'm just not sure. I guess, because this isn't even a trigger warning, right? Like, I put that into a completely different category. Like, that's a different phenomenon. It's about trauma and other kinds of things. This is more like, what amount of content pre-knowledge is actually a reader service or a reader, I guess, excuse or attenuates the reading experience? Because I think about 75% of through the way this book, I figured they would both live. Like, that would put my betting, though it wasn't sort of a capital R romance assurance to me. I don't know. I'm not, I kind of just, it's kind of more of a thought experiment, right? Because it does feel like it would have mattered. Now, if the mouse had lived, there's no way I would even told my daughter that this book flipping existed, because I got to get through my days. I got to get her to sleep at night. We only have so many Kleenex in the house. Like, if the flipping mouse dies and it's just a woman by herself or vice versa, or they both, like, I can't even tell my daughter about that. What good am I doing to her at that point? So I don't know. I'm not sure. Any help, any solutions here, Sharifa? What should we do here? Put a sticker on it? You just numbs the break. Sometimes the mouse dies. I don't know.
I mean, I wouldn't mind something at the beginning, like, you know, like almost like a content warning, but it's more like a how much emotional toil are you willing put into your reading experience in this moment? Here is a way for you to gauge where your emotions are at and how much you are willing to exercise them in this particular way. I don't have a solution, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I don't really either, because I hate it. Because even in having something on there, you're taking away the reader's choice about whether or not to know. I don't know. Here you go.
Yeah.
A QR code on the back of the book. It's like, if you want to know a couple of content things that, you know, you may be wondering, especially if you're reading the jacket copy about an old woman who befriends a mouse, you're probably wondering, do these people make it through this text? It's not the craziest idea in the world. But okay, so you could put the QR code on there. If you don't want to look at it, it doesn't tell you anything. You can just ignore it. But if you're like, you know what, I really need to know something before I even decide to pick this up, the QR code is sipsworth.com/whatever, and it says the mouse lives and the lady lives. And that's all it says. That's all that's there.
That is one of few QR codes I could get behind.
That's right.
Generally not a fan, but
no.
That is a useful use of it.
I have found myself using them more frequently of late. World, and I don't know. I think Rebecca and I talked about this. I think it was a COVID thing. You know, they didn't have print menus, or you need to do this other kind of stuff.
They were on the cusp of dying, and then the pandemic definitely dredged them up from.
Yeah, that void. And sourdough bread. Do you remember when you couldn't find yeast? I remember one night trying to go to every flipping grocery store in Portland looking for yeast to make bread. Sold out.
I remember our colleague Danica talking about how she couldn't find nutritional yeast because she's vegan, because people mistook nutritional yeast for yeast you could use for starter, which was hilarious to me.
Think of all the failed bolos that people tried to make. Sad flatbreads that turned out, like, what happened?
Flat cheesy flavor.
Yeah, flat bread. Cheesy bread. This is not at all what Alton Brown said it was going to look like. Anyway, all right. Well, there we go. Thanks so much for joining me, Sharifa. You can find show notes if you stuck around again and didn't remember 5 seconds ago, or for the hundreds of episodes you may have listened to, bookriot.com/listen. Moms, dads, and grads, kind of your last warning a few days after this comes out. Probably Rebecca's on break. I don't think we're recording until Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. So take your shot. For that, go check out First Edition. You can even hear me and Josh talking about The Orchard by Adele Crockett Robertson, which I love, but that's out a few weeks. But especially hear me talking to John Philip Santos about House on Mango Street. I guess I'll preview. If you're sticking around, too, if you don't want to know what's coming out in First Edition, I guess you can also another chance to hang up the phone if you want. But I'm so excited. Just on Wednesday, I did an episode with Ada Limón, the U.S. National Poet Laureate, about her reading life, her life as a reader. So I broke out that old format from the Reading Lives podcast. We had a great time. We talked about Shel Silverstein. We talked about dogs dying in middle grade literature. Oh, it was fantastic. She was a joy. That's going to come out sometime in May. Coming out a week from, I guess it'll be Thursday by the time you're listening to this, coming out the first Thursday in May, an episode with Rachel Kong about Real Americans, her book, which is coming out next week. Also had a really good conversation with her. I talked to Claire Massoud about her new book. Talked to Ayanna Mathis so about the paperback of The Unsettled. Got a lot of people coming up. I'm so excited. So sign up for First Edition and listen to whichever of those sounds exciting to you. Sharifa, we'll talk to you later.